I didn't quite have a category for Gordon. One day I would be sitting there and having just the sweetest possible conversation with him about Jesus. I'm just like, oh, my heart's touched. And then the very next day I would see him speaking extremely harshly to his wife. He appeared to be a fairly terrible husband. And yet he showed me what radical grace looks like. So one day he was driving his Tahoe and some poor young woman smashed her junker into his Tahoe, caused thousands of dollars of damage, totaled her car, and then he found out that she was pregnant and now didn't have a car or any way to get to work. So he, to this complete and utter stranger, he loaned his Cadillac to her indefinitely for months on end to a complete stranger. Radical grace. He was surprisingly generous. He owned an old sports car, 1965 Shelby Cobra. And he needed to take it to a mechanic one day, and he asked me if I'd give him a ride home from dropping it off. So he dropped it off, then I give him the ride back. And on the way back, he notices that my car, my old station wagon, Chevy station wagon that I was driving at the time, did not have air conditioning in Dallas, Texas. And it didn't. And he was like, this is impossible, Paul. You can't live like this. I'm going to fix your air conditioning. And I explained to him, like, fixing the air conditioning will literally cost three times what this car is worth. And he said, I don't care. I'm fixing your air conditioning. And he did. He was pretty radically kind and generous to me. But then I later discovered that he was pretty unkind and ungenerous to his own children. When his wife turned 60, he spent $50,000 for this one-night blowout at one of the best restaurants in Dallas just to celebrate her. But then a couple months later, we discovered that whole time, for months on end, he had been actually cheating on her. And then he eventually left her. So he was this strange mixture of like grace, generosity, and like this repulsive selfishness, this like relationship-destroying sin. I didn't quite know what to do with it. Growing up, my life had been much simpler. There were like good people and bad people, right? Good people went to church. Well, not every church, my church. Good people went to my church. And then there were bad people, like people who cuss and drink and listen to Van Halen and like vote for Democrats. Yeah, those were the bad people. I'm not sure if I was ever actually taught this or if this is just like how my little brain kind of made sense of the world, but that's how I viewed it. Good people, bad people. But then there's Gordon and people like Gordon who just completely messed up my categories. He was one of the best human beings I'd ever met and one of the worst. I wasn't sure whether to embrace him or despise him, shun him or honor him. And the question I was asking is like, is Jesus really at work in his life? Or is he just this twisted, selfish, broken person that I see in front of me? Which is it? Of course, with maturity, I've come to see that that same question could be asked of me. And to the extent that I know you, and you know yourself, you could probably ask that same question of yourself. With maturity, I've not just seen that that question applies to me. I've also seen that these two, that the grace of God and my sin, aren't necessarily in contrast. God is not held back by my sin. He works in both. Like, he can work through my brokenness just as much as he can work through my wholeness. In fact, the greatest saints I know, the people in this room right now who exude Jesus in ways that no one else does in this room, those people, I know enough about their story to know that their story comes from a lifetime of hurt and sin and brokenness. And that's how God made them who they are today. And this brings us back to the story of Abram. I find this story like oddly comforting, I think, if that's the word. In his story, I feel like I can begin to make sense of my own story, that whatever I've done, whatever Gordon did, whatever you've done, Abram's done worse and better, and God worked in both. So last week we introduced this man named Abram and his wife Sarai, who later became Abraham and Sarah. He's the father of faith, and we noted that this is not just some like middle Bronze Age story about some nomadic patriarchal ruler. This is the father of faith, the journey of faith, the family of God. And if you've heard the promises of God, if you're on a journey of faith, if you consider yourself a child of God, then this isn't just Abraham's story. It's yours and it's mine. This is our family history. We're heirs to a set of patterns, habits, attitudes, tragedies, victories that shape our very souls. That to come to know their stories is to come to know our own story. To speak out loud their past is to confess our present. To learn how they walked with God is to learn how we can walk with God. This week, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 13 and 14. Two chapters. I know. Yeah. Get comfortable. In this, I do want to encourage you, if you want to follow along in the pew Bible, it's, I think, page 11 or 12 in the pew Bible. In this, we're going to ask this question, like, how does Abram, the great saint, the great sinner, make progress on his journey of faith? Like, what needs to happen to him, for him, in him, that he might begin to see the promises of God? What needs to happen to him, in him, through him, for him, so that he can begin to see the promises of God? If you were here last week, you'll remember we left off at the end of Genesis chapter 12, and there we saw that there was a severe famine. There's a severe famine in the land, the promised land, so that drove Abram and Sarai down to Egypt, and they went down to Egypt, but along the way, he turned to Sarah and said, hey, here's the problem. You are so beautiful that when everyone sees you, they're going to want to take you from me, and they'll kill me so that they can have you. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to lie. Say you're my sister. And they go down to Egypt, and his plan works perfectly. Pharaoh sees her, that she's beautiful, takes her as his wife, and pays Abram handsomely for his wife, for his sister. But then the Lord plagues Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's like, what have you done to me? Why didn't you tell me she's your wife? What is the Lord doing to me because of this? You go! And he sends him back to the promised land. He speaks the very word of God to him. Pharaoh speaks the word of God to Abram and says, go. What God told you, you need to do that. And he lets him have all these riches as he goes. We pick up the story in Genesis chapter 13, starting in verse 1. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, which is southern Israel, with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Now, the journey from Egypt to the Promised Land is a long one on foot. And commentators down through the ages have noted something that's missing from this verse, and that is any dialogue. There's no dialogue. There's no explanation. There's no... Because what do you say after what just happened in Egypt? So, Abram, you just prostituted your wife and made yourself really wealthy. Now you're hauling back all the riches to the promised land. Do you want to talk about it? And the answer seems to be, no. No, I don't. Abram had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. The word translated very, as in very wealthy here, is the exact same word that was used to describe the life-threatening famine that sent him down to Egypt. It was a very famine and now very wealthy, or a severe famine. Now he's severely wealthy, which leads us to ask, as you read through this text, should we understand that he's very wealthy or severely wealthy? Is this a blessing or is this a curse? Is this some type of life-threatening ailment that he's bringing home with him right now? The Apostle Paul will describe wealth this way when he writes to Timothy. He says, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered away from the faith, and listen to this, and pierced themselves with many griefs. So, Abraham, you just made yourself severely wealthy, but at what cost? From the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier, and where he had built his first, had first built an altar. There, Abram called on the name of the Lord. So he goes back to the very place that we saw he was in last week. And there, in that place, he goes back to the promised land and he returns to the Lord. But this is when all of his wealth is going to start causing problems. Look at verse 5. Now Lot, who was moving about with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. But the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abram's herders and Lot's. The Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. So there's this dispute over the land. They have so much wealth that they cannot share the land. And land in that, when wealth is measured in terms of cattle and sheep, land in this economy is essential. So the lack of land is a threat to your future, your family, your security. And when they get there and they're so severely wealthy that they can no longer share the land, it's going to threaten their relationship. And I want you to pay attention to this. This is not just some side issue. This is not just some distraction. This is the main story here. This is the journey of faith. This is where it all takes place. Abram's faith in God is lived out and worked out, get this, in interpersonal relationships with his wife, with his nephew, with his neighbors, with his servants. And this becomes instructive to us as you think through your journey of faith. Your journey of faith is not just what you do in 5 minutes as you sit and pause and practice the presence of God for 5 minutes over lunch, which you should do, and I'm glad you're doing right now, right? But that's not where it's basically lived out and worked out. It is worked out in interpersonal relationships with your family, with your coworkers, with your neighbors and friends. To quote the Apostle John, if you don't love the people right in front of you that you can see, how could you possibly love the God that you can't see? Or in this context, if you can't learn to be friends with the people around you, how are you ever going to learn to become a friend of God? So the last time Abram felt physically and emotionally threatened, what did he do? Well, he threw his wife under the bus. That's what he did. So what's he going to do here? So Abram said to Lot, let's not have any quarreling between you and me or between your herders and mine, for we are close relatives. Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. So in that ancient Near Eastern culture, in that world, Abram is the head of the clan. He's the tribal chieftain. He is the paterfamilias. And that meant he had basically absolute authority over everyone and everything underneath him. That would include Lot. That means he has the legal, God-given right to choose whatever he wants or choose it all or choose to kill Lot if he chooses to. And there's nothing that anyone could do or say about it. So he has every right to take whatever area he wants, but he doesn't. He doesn't demand what is rightfully his. He lays down his rights. He doesn't protect himself, but setting aside his rights, he makes himself vulnerable. And this is notable. The commentator Victor Hamilton says it this way, explains it. In refusing to exercise the prerogatives of the paterfamilias, the head of the household, Abram essentially releases any part of the promised land to Lot. In doing so, he is prepared to sacrifice what has been promised to him. He's prepared to sacrifice what has been promised to him. Do you hear this? So just in last chapter in Egypt, he exploits his own wife, makes her vulnerable in order to protect himself, in order to make himself rich. But here we just turn one page over and he sets aside his own rights. He makes himself nothing. He becomes vulnerable. He refuses to take it for himself, which begs the question, what's changed? Like, where's the insecure, self-protective, immoral pragmatist that we saw in Egypt? Where is he? Who is this generous, vulnerable, open-handed person? Like, is this some act of penance? Do you feel really, really bad about what happened to Sarai and now you're trying to make it up with Lot? Or is God beginning to change his heart? Has God's kindness led him to repentance? Is God's grace beginning to do its work in him? The text, it doesn't really say anything here. All we know is that Abram makes this surprisingly generous offer to Lot. He just open-handed says, I'm letting go. You can have whatever you want, and I will take whatever's left over. The scholar Bill Arnold suggests that within that culture, one would expect then Lot to say, oh, no, no, no. You are the paterfamilias. You're the one who should choose, not me. But surprisingly, Lot says, oh, you're willing to give it up? Great. I will take the very best place for myself. So verse 10, Lot looked around and saw the whole plain of Jordan towards Zoar was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. So he looks around and says, that place over there, that looks like the garden of the Lord. That looks like paradise. That looks like the Garden of Eden. And this is a bit foreboding here, because this language here reminds us of another incident that happened in the garden of the Lord. That when the woman saw, when she looked, that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing the eye, she took some and ate it. Same language here, reflected in Lot. Eve, Lot, same language. This is not to say that Lot's choice was sinful. He is not breaking the commandment the way Adam and Eve did. But we do catch a whiff that something's off here, because he compares the land to not only paradise, he compares it to Egypt, which for an ancient Israelite would immediately be like, ooh, Egypt is the place that promises you life and great riches, but actually leads you into slavery. And in case we miss it, the narrator then explains, this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Oh, yeah, that. So Lot, he looks around and says, look at this place. There's great housing, short commutes, an amazing farmer's market, bike trails everywhere. Look at this. This is perfect. Low cost of living, low crime. I'll take it. And then we find out that it's in this cute little neighborhood called Sodom and Gomorrah. So to an original audience reading this, this sounds like this. Chasing after paradise, he moves his family to hell. Again, this is not to say that Lot's choice is sinful. There's nothing wrong with wanting the very best life, but in pursuing these things, Lot is overlooking what this move is going to do to his family and to his own soul. Which begs the question, what exactly is the best life? So Lot chose for himself. Hear that word, grasped for himself. The woman, she took for herself the fruit. And Lot takes for himself. He chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out towards the east. The two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tent near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. So do you see a theme developing here? First Abram, now Lot. They are ignoring how their decisions will affect their families. They're ignoring how their decisions will affect their families. And it's working. It's working. They are severely wealthy. So wealthy. It's so successful. It's so amazing. But in the process, Abram had to prostitute his own wife. And Lot is going to destroy his family. Which begs the question, how do you make life decisions? How do you choose the school, the house, the job, the opportunity, which one you'll take? What kind of questions do you ask? Do you ask, will this make me wealthy? Will this lead to success? Does this look good? Or do you ask questions like, who will I become if I live in this place, if I take this job, if I take this house, if I live like this? How will this shape the soul of my children? Will this make us more loving, more present, more generous, more kind, more present to God, more open to other people, or will it close us off? You see, Lot, he didn't ask any of those questions. Do you? The Lord said to Abram after Lot had parted from him, look around from where you are to the north and south, to the east and west. All the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. So within the story of Abram, it's a little bit hard to pick up in the English, but over and over and over again, if you're tuned into this, in the Hebrew for sure, you see this word see, seeing, look, over and over and over again. It forms this major theme through the life of Abram, later Abraham. Here, we see this comparison. Lot looks and sees what he thinks is paradise, and he moves his family to hell. And the Lord now turns to Abram and says to him, look around. I am going to show you my promises right here, right now in the land of Canaan. And I know, with your eyes, it looks like nothing. It looks like a land that is actually filled with Canaanites. But this is the promised land. And this gives us two very different ways of seeing get laid out in this text. The first is the way of Lot. The second is the way of Abram here. Lot is a very human way of seeing things. You measure it. You look at it. You say, is that attractive? Is that good to me? It's logical. It makes sense. This is the place of my dream. So you chase after it. The second way is a God-given vision. And it only makes sense if you trust the promises of God. Like, there's nothing much to see with your actual eyes, just some earth and some space filled with Canaanites. But if you have eyes to see, it is the promised land. And I want you to notice the difference between the two. Lot, his just comes naturally. We all just naturally see things this way. But Abram, it only comes on the other side of surrender. It's only after he gives up the land of the Lord. After he says, Lord, I'm not going to try and control this. I'm not going to try and take it for myself. I'm opening up myself to you. I'm surrendering in that. Then he begins to see what God sees. You see, the promises of God cannot be taken for yourself. The way Adam and Eve, they take what they want in the garden, the way Lot takes what he wants in the land. The promises of God, the life that is truly life, what you really want, even if you can't put it in words, that can't be taken, can't be purchased, can't be earned, can't be won. It can only be received as a gift. And this is a hard lesson to learn. It's going to take Abram years. I personally have known this lesson. Like, I've known this. I know this. You can only receive it as a gift. The life I really want, I can only receive it as a gift. And yet I have to seemingly relearn this over and over and over again. I like to be in the driver's seat. You can ask my wife. I like to be in control. I want to manage things. I don't like letting go, but I know I will never see the promises of God. I will never find the life that is truly life when I am in control. And there's a reason. There's a reason why in the Old Testament, when God set up worship with the ancient Israelites, he made the whole burnt offering, the offering that represents complete and utter surrender to the Lord, he made them do it every morning and every night. Every morning and every night. Last week, we sang Psalm 46. And it is a powerful, arresting psalm. I love it. The psalmist is there and he's like, the whole earth is the pillars of the earth are shaken. The mountains are falling into the sea. The sea's going to overtake me. My life is coming apart at the seams. And then in the midst of that, you see that God, he is not shaken. He's not anxious. He's still in control, and you can trust him. You can hide yourself in him. And then in the midst of that psalm, we have those famous words, be still, just be still and know that I am God. Here's the thing with that translation, though. The phrase translated be still is the Hebrew word harpu, which is fairly common. You find it all over the Old Testament. But this, of all the places that it occurs in the Old Testament, this is the only place in the Old Testament it's actually translated be still. Every other translation is relax, loosen, surrender, let go. My favorite example is in the love poem from Song of Songs, when we read, when I found the one my heart loves, I held him and would not let him go. I would not let him go. So does harpu mean to be still? Maybe, sure. So long as be still isn't just about quietness or a lack of motion here. Harpu implies surrender to God, relaxing, trusting, letting go, letting down, pressing into the fact that I can't solve this. I can't save myself, and it's okay. In fact, it's good. You see, when Abram, when he surrenders himself to God, when he makes himself vulnerable, when he lets go of control, God shows him something that he could never, ever see on his own. And I wonder, I'm curious, do you think that maybe God wants to show us something, but we can only see it if we let go first, if we surrender? So Abram went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he pitched his tents. There he built an altar to the Lord. And then we flip to chapter 14, and with the flip of the page, the story takes a hard turn. Bear with me here. At that time, when Amraphel was king of Shinar, Arioch king of Elasar, Kedorlaomer king of Elam, and Tidal king of Goyim. Okay, I'm going to stop reading now. Yeah. This is the part of the text where we realize we are reading an ancient Bronze Age text. Right? Who are these kings? How do you say their names? Do we know anything about any of this? And the answer is not really. Not really. So this is like if you were to fast forward 4,000 years from now and try and explain to someone the war in Ukraine, to someone who's like never heard of Putin, never heard of Russia, never heard of Ukraine. So I don't want to lose you in the ancient Near Eastern geopolitics here. So let me summarize. At the time, if there were powerful kings, and if you're a powerful king and you saw a less powerful king, you would come to him and say, hey, I like you and I want to let you live. I really do. And I want to let you keep your little kingdom. It's cute. I like it. But here's what you got to do in order to keep your kingdom and not have me kill you. For the privilege of keeping your kingdom and living, you are going to call me the great king, honor me in your kingdom, and you are going to pay me monthly. Yeah? Deal? Now, the little king, he could agree, the vassal is what it's called, could agree to that and say, yes, you are the king of kings, you're the great king, or he could say, let's fight. Didn't usually go well for them if they did. But as you can imagine, the little king and his little kingdom, they did not like this. So in this story, we're going to find that there are five little kings, vassal kings, all in the region where Lot's living near Sodom. And all of them, they come together and say, hey, we are sick of having these overlords take all of our money and stomp upon us. So we are going to band together these five kings and we are going to throw a rebellion. But then these four powerful kings, overlords, they form an alliance and they come to squash the rebellion. Along the way, we read in verse 2, some of the little kings, their names, we read of note, Bera was king of Sodom and Birsha, king of Gomorrah, which I'm guessing is not their real names because it basically reads like Dr. Evil and Mr. Wicked. Yeah, So Bera in Hebrew literally means in evil, and Birsha means in wickedness. All right? Yeah. So along the way, they band together, and they form this rebellion. War breaks out, but then, as you might imagine, the powerful kings just completely crush the rebellion. Everyone's fleeing for their lives. The armies of the great kings then sweep through the entire region and say, now we are going to not only crush you, we're going to take all of your stuff. And as they do, they take all the people, livestock, everything from that land. And in the process, they take Lot and all of his stuff because he happens to be living in that land. Pick up the story in verse 14. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. That's way up at the end of the promised land. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and all the other people. All right, get it? So on one level, this is a really simple story. They've been taken captive by these great kings. Abram now puts on his warrior hat. He gathers his 318 men, goes after them, rescues Lot, right? So on one level, this is pretty simple, pretty straightforward. But there might be, probably is, something else going on in this text that likely doesn't even pop up on your radar because, well, you are not a Middle Bronze Age person. So a couple weeks ago, David Baba, who's our pastor of spiritual formation, he and I were having a conversation about the importance of reading a biblical text in light of the original culture. Reading the text in light of the original culture. And David said something that I thought was really helpful. He said, in 200 years, people will not know the difference between a butt dial and a booty call. I thought that was stunningly brilliant. Because, I mean, pay attention to this. A butt dial and booty call, linguistically, they are the same. They mean the same thing, but they are not the same. Now, if you don't know the difference between those two, just turn to a young person after church and ask them. I dare you. It'll be fun. And yet, as big as the difference is in their actual meaning, linguistically, they're identical, so that the only way you would know any difference between these two phrases is if you were immersed in our culture. If you're not part of our culture, you would have no idea. In fact, I was talking to the missionary, and he was like, what does that mean? I was like, oh. This brings me to 318. In our culture, a number is a number. That's the last I checked, it's a number. But if we were to immerse ourselves in a Middle Bronze Age culture, does 318 mean just 318? Or is there some subtle nuance that we might be missing? Now, let me say up front, I sincerely do not know. I don't know. But what I do know is that in ancient Hebrew, letters doubled as numbers. They didn't have separate letters and numbers. And so rabbis of old have pointed to the fact that the number 318 is the number of the name of Abraham's head servant, Eliezer, who will get introduced in the next chapter. Huh. And then other rabbis have pointed out that if you take all the prime numbers from 7 to 7 times 7 and you add them up, you will get the number 318. Who took the time to do that? Once you start going down this road, though, you're going to find this type of thing everywhere in the Old Testament. I mean, probably most famously, the sevens in Genesis 1. Here's just a few of them. Genesis 1:1 has seven words composed of 28 letters, 7 times 4. The second verse has 14 words, 7 times 2. The phrase, it was so, and God saw, and it was good, all occur 7 times. The word earth occurs 21 times, 7 times 3. The seventh paragraph has 35 words, 7 times 5. The word God occurs 35 times, 7 times 5. And the total in the chapter, the total number of words is 469, which is 7 times 67. Last week we saw in the genealogies that the numbers 7 and 10 seem to have really significance. That at the 7th generation and 10th generation, something big happens in their culture. Turn to Genesis chapter 5 and you start looking at the ages. Here we find this list of genealogy listing all these people who live 7, 8, 900 years. Methuselah famously lives 969 years. But if you start paying attention to all these numbers, like the age at which they had their first child, how long they lived after, and when they died, you start looking at all those, you're like, huh, well, there's something interesting in here. Every single one of those numbers ends with a 0, 2, 5, 7, or there's 1, 9, just Methuselah's age. Huh. That's kind of bizarre. I mean, out of all of these ages, no one had their child in a year that ended in 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8. No one died on one of those years. No one lived extra that many years. So that must be a fluke. Like, how weird is that? But then statistically, you start looking at it. What are the chances that all of these just randomly selected just happen to miss those 5 other years? And we find that it's a 1 in 100 million chance that it would only be those numbers. That doesn't seem like a fluke. Get the ages of Abraham and his children. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, 175 years, 180 years, 147 years. That just happens to be 7 times 5 times 5. 5 times 6 times 6. 3 times 7 times 7. Which just makes you say, like, who thinks like this? And who sat around to actually do the math to figure this out? And then begs the question, Paul, are you outing yourself as a liberal progressive heretic? Are you saying that the Bible isn't literally true? Are you telling me that Methuselah isn't literally 969 years? And I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that these numbers almost are more than literal numbers, not necessarily less. I'm not saying that these are not literal numbers. I'm just pointing out that these are almost certainly trying to say something more, something deeper, something bigger to us in these numbers. So let me be clear. If you came to me and said, Paul, I can't believe it. I cannot believe that Methuselah lived 969 years. I would go, oh, were you talking to me? Oh, was I supposed to argue with you right now? Was I supposed to argue with you and tell you, oh, this is why people could live for up to 1,000 years under a pre-diluvian world in which there was a great water canopy, and that's why their bodies could somehow live? And I'm like, I don't care. But if you came to me and said, Paul, I cannot believe that these numbers have some deeper meaning in them, those are fighting words. Those are fighting words. You see, I am not claiming any special knowledge of a hidden secret meaning in the number 318. I really have no idea whether that means something or not. I really don't. But I am saying that I live in a world created by a God who made everything by his word, and that is not an impersonal force. It's a man named Jesus. And so every single thing that is created cries out his name, speaks of him, everything. We live in a world that has drained all meaning from everything, so we just see things as things, and we just see numbers as numbers. And I am saying that in God's world, nothing just happened. Nothing. Everything points us to Christ if we have eyes to see and ears to hear. Again, I could totally be wrong. I have no idea what 318 means. But I know enough to know that our tendency is to drain all the meaning out of everything. And if we miss out on the work of God in this, we might miss out on, well, what's about to come in the text. So after Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer, the king, and the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God, Most High. And he blessed Abram, saying, blessed be Abram, by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand. Then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. So, from a literal, historical, linguistic reading of this text, this is almost meaningless. Almost meaningless. We know nothing about this king except that his name means my king is righteous. My king is righteousness. He's from Salem, which we don't know where that's from, but from a much later text, it suggests that Salem is actually Jerusalem. If we assume that he's a Canaanite, then his priestly blessing makes almost no sense. He says, God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, but there is no Canaanite God by this name. It takes two names, two Canaanite gods, El and Elyon, neither of which are creator gods, though. Neither of which. So it's referring to two separate gods. There is no El Elyon, and neither of these gods are creator gods. And to make matters more confusing, Abram will refer to this god, El Elyon, the creator god, as his god, as Yahweh. Abram seems convinced that Melchizedek is a priest king serving Yahweh, his God. Except that Yahweh will not establish a priesthood for 500 more years and will not establish a king for 1,000 more years. So how could this be a priest king who represents Yahweh? And why does Abraham give him a tithe, the tenth of everything he has, as though Melchizedek is some great king to whom he owes allegiance? Again, we don't know. So if we only accept a literal interpretation of this text, this is meaningless. There's no meaning in this text. It's just some ancient thing that happened. But followers of God down through the ages, both Jews and Christians, have seen in this text something deeply meaningful. This priest-king, this king of righteousness from Jerusalem, this one who's greater than Abram, is one who comes out of nowhere and blesses Abram, the father of faith, over bread and wine. The ancient Jews, they read this and they said, this, Psalm 110, this is Messiah. This is what we're looking for. A priest who can bring us back into relationship with God. A king who can defeat our enemies and rule over our hearts. One who's so great that even Abram himself would bend his knee to him. One who can speak for God himself. And when he speaks, he speaks a blessing. And the early Christians, they read this and said, this, Hebrews chapter 7, this sounds like Jesus. He's before the priest and the kings of Israel. He's our great high priest. He's the king of kings. He's greater than Abram. When we meet him, when we experience his blessing, we meet him in bread and wine. So Melchizedek is literally a meaningless historical figure about whom we know nothing, literally. But if you have eyes of faith, if you can begin to see what God's up to, then you will see that perhaps he is the clearest picture of Jesus Christ we have in the book of Genesis. Again, two very, very different ways of seeing, a literal way and a way that sees Jesus in all things. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. So here he's like, take all the goods. Abram, you just want it. You want it. You keep it, all the money. Make yourself rich. Be severely rich if you want, but just give me the people back. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, with raised hand, I have sworn an oath to the Lord, the God most high, creator of heaven and earth, the God of Melchizedek, that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me. Let them have their share. So having experienced severe wealth, having seen the promises of God, having received the blessing through Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, Abram's like, I cannot be tempted by all the wealth of Sodom. All that you could give me, you cannot give me the life I really want. You can't give me the life I really want. Only God can give me that. I can't earn it. I can't take it for myself. I can't win it in a battle. Only God can give me what I really want. So when he forfeits his rights, when he makes himself vulnerable, when he places his future entirely in the hands of God, then Abram, the great saint, the great sinner, while he makes his next step on his journey of faith. This is the step where he learns to surrender his life into God's hands, and through that, he begins to see the promises of God. But as we go through the story, we're going to find this is just a beginning, and he has a long, long ways to go, just like most of us. What about you? You great saints, you great sinners, where are you at in your journey? What people or frustrations or dreams or wealth or opportunities do you need to surrender to God? Like, what would it look like for you to let go and know that he is God? To let go of trying to grasp it for yourself? Like, is the Spirit pointing to an area of blindness where you're seeing things the wrong way, something that he wants you to see, but the only way that you'll be able to see it is on the other side of surrender?